Would you bow your heads and let's pray together. Sweet Jesus, open our eyes. Swing us up onto your shoulders. Show us the view we've been missing. Awaken us to your glorious activity in our lives and in the world. We call upon your name, the most precious of all names, to accomplish this in our hearts this weekend. Amen. On a fishing trip with my son a few years ago, I was walking a gravel road in Idaho, and I came across the sign that was meant to say historic site ahead, but unfortunately a very important letter was rubbed, the paint was rubbed off, and so it said historic sit ahead. That's tragic. You have not come for a historic sit, and I am not going to let you have a historic sit. But I'm hoping that by God's grace, you would have a monument in your life, a time where there was a revelation, however small, that God could use to redirect and say, I remember that camp. And I'm wanting this to be more than a time when you can have good information and a good time. You'll get both, but I want to make sure that this is a special time for you on content. Romans 1, 11 through 12, Paul writes, I long to see you that I may give you a gift to strengthen you, that is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. I come with the same heart. I love you. I'm grateful for you. I'm grateful to be in the presence of God with you and to explore what he has done in our lives together. I've come to give you a break from COVID because there's so much more to life. And I've come to give you a break from politics because there's so much more to life. Seismic events are underway in our world, massive tectonic shifts that we can't ignore. But I've come to you to remind you of those things that don't shift with the times. Let's set aside for a moment the seismic but temporal for the eternal and immutable. I'd like this weekend to be an extended celebration of the way God uses story to move our hearts. To move our hearts, you need to remember this, transform our hearts, and propel us to action. So, you should probably know that I am a lifelong storyteller to my mother's chagrin. I had to recount absolutely everything in detail, including movies I saw. She never needed to see a movie. I already told her all the details. I take great comfort from C.S. Lewis, who said, we read to know that we're not alone. I think I tell stories to know that I'm not alone because you can see people's interaction. They're like, hey, that's just how I feel. And you go, hey, good, I'm not alone in the world. I hated reading books, though. Absolutely. They were so boring. I'd rather write my own. Some of you young men may know what I'm talking about. Through sixth grade, there were only two stories worth reading. One was The Hobbit, and the other classic was The Black Stallion. One of you has read that. That's great. You guys need to get out more, that's for sure. So I gravitated towards stories all my life, even with my limited attention span, and I ended up deciding to teach great stories because they've always mesmerized me. For three things, their power to move us, transform us, and propel us to action. It's incredible how God has wired us for those things. These three powers of story are at the heart of our passage for the weekend, Isaiah 40, verse 9. So if you have your Bibles, you can open to Isaiah 40, verse 9. Which says, go on up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good news. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift it up. Fear not. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. This is the very word of God. You'll remember that Isaiah is prophesying during 40 years of incredible political and social turmoil. And the first 39 chapters. I've got people here who can correct me. But the first 39 chapters are judgment. And the last section, the remaining chapters, are consolation. So that's 39 and onward are consolation. This is chapter 40. So it's right at the beginning of consolation. But you'll notice this doesn't sound like your typical consolation, comfort. It's a rallying cry, which then makes sense of the rest of the chapters. Okay? So let's unpack this verse. Notice four things. Our job description. We are given a title we don't get to choose. Herald of Good News. We're given that title twice. We're either doing it well or we're doing it poorly, but it's our job description. Now, there's no such thing as good news without hope, right? So they go together, and we have to have a hopeful spirit if we're possibly going to communicate good news. So that seems to me a high calling and a rare accomplishment, honestly, if we're honest with ourselves. John Calvin takes these verses as a charge to boldly draw others with us to high ground where we can cherish good hope when matters are at their worst. Furthermore, he says that the more that wickedness prevails and fear abounds in the world, the more we ought to extol the grace of God and trumpet this good news from the mountaintop regardless of how we're doing. Wouldn't you say that time has come? Second, God commands us to lift up our voice loudly and fearlessly. It forces us to give the gospel a voice. There's no privatized Sunday religion here. Number three, it forces us to fix our eyes on Jesus, beholding him. The word beholding comes from the Old English beholden, which means to catch like a bird in the hand, to hold it fast, which is an interesting way of thinking of the way we see things, right? To capture it and hold it fast, not just take it in as we're becoming more accustomed to in passing digital world, right? But to hold it. So God calls us to thoroughly catch hold of him so that we can help others thoroughly catch hold of him. We can't behold what we're not looking at. If we're not looking at Jesus, then what in God's name has our attention? Number four, it forces us to look up and lean out. This verse is less about geography or eschatology as much as it is about your heart posture. This is a call for you to join the rest of God's people, regardless of denomination or personality, in effectively telling the beautiful story of God's redeeming work in the world and in your life. Effectively, therein lies the problem, isn't it? We're not as faithful or as effective as we'd like to be at giving the gospel a voice. We lack the courage. We lack the personality. We don't know what to say. We tend to start fights or whatever it is that we don't mean to do. We find ourselves frustrated by this inability to reach people, by bridging that gap between us with this good news that we know we have, but we have a hard time sharing. Our sin and distraction keep us from being effective too. We have a difficult enough time beholding God ourselves, so who are we to kid ourselves into thinking we can help other people behold him too? It's a little bit like parenting, right? You have this crisis when you realize, I have to discipline this child because they're exactly like me. How's this going to work? We're also ineffective because our hopefulness is mostly theoretical. Many of us are just like Eeyore. Right? Hope is pretty unlikely. Some of us are Tiggers, super hopeful for about 9 seconds. And the rest of us are poo, just trying to find something yummy to enjoy in this rather bleak life. So how do we more faithfully and effectively give the gospel a voice? How do we more effectively incarnate it? How do we see more clearly? How do we live more hopefully? We need to start telling our stories and the stories of our people. We need to remember and record and reaffirm what God has done in our lives. We need to reclaim the lived narrative of God's faithfulness. We need to tell our stories as a resistance to the onslaught of meaninglessness. And in our circles, the temptation to settle into a cerebral relationship with God and with each other. Remembering, recording, and reaffirming what God has done in our lives reminds us that he is as much at work in our lives as he was in King David's or Paul's. We rob God of great glory when we stop telling our stories. When we stop telling our stories, we stop remembering, we stop noticing, and we stop beholding. That's why the psalmist writes in Psalm 78, "Give ear, O my people, to my teaching. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings from of old, things that we have heard and known that our fathers have told us." We will not hide them from their children, but tell to the coming generation the glorious deeds of the Lord and his might and the wonders that he has done. The rest of Psalm 78 is full of just abbreviated stories. They're just one after the another reminder to say, hey, remember that one time? And then a story is triggered, right? That's all the rest of Psalm 78. So, hey, Spencer, could you save my bacon and bring that bench up here, and then I'll have my water near me? Small advertising break. So here's my story. Inspired by Jim and Elizabeth Elliot, my dad decided to become a missionary doctor when I was 5 years old and moved to Lugulu, Kenya, which it's not even a town. It's like those places you pass somewhere in Idaho, where you realize, I think I passed something just now. I think it was a town. We moved from Tucson, Arizona to you folks from Idaho are giving me some nasty looks. I don't know why. I don't deserve this. Kenton got me in a bad mood. So this place is so small. It's just a hospital and a boarding school. That was it, a little outlying huts. That was my childhood. I could run 100 yards from my house and look out over the valley into Uganda in the far distance. In my heart, honestly, I'm still a barefooted country boy from rural Africa, which sounds romantic to you, but let me tell you, it is as unromantic as they get. No giraffes, no lions, no big city, no America. I ran clay paths with my friends. In fact, We'd punch a stick in the ground. You would not believe what that bad boy could become. It became a gear shifter on a great big bus. We'd have a load of passengers. We'd just crisscross applesauce, but we were flying all over the country with just a stick in the ground. For the other amusement, we would take plastic bags and tie them as tight as we could into a soccer ball, which if you tie them tight enough, it can become a projectile. It's great fun. Those little Hot Wheels that you can buy for like a buck on sale, maybe, at Safeway, those things were absolutely priceless. Only the super rich had Hot Wheels. And so I was given a Hot Wheel by a guest who came to our house, a little hatchback. It was super cute, and I was so enamored. I was never going to be the same again. And of course, this very, very, very much poorer person than me, this little kid, came in admiring my toy, and my dad gave me the look. I had an existential crisis at the age of 6. God must hate me, right? But I gave the car to this kid begrudgingly, and Dad taught me a lesson I hope I'll never forget. He said, "Son, God is not in the business of taking from his children. He's in the business of giving to his children. What looks like loss always turns to gain. When you open your hand and let things go, God fills your hands with goodness you could never imagine." This isn't, by the way, in case you're worried, the prosperity gospel. This is simply the surprise of God. Not all gains are financial or material, but some are. A complete stranger, the next day, saw me and said, "Hey, I got something for you. And I opened this 4x4 Jeep Hot Wheel, the absolute upper echelon of all Hot Wheels, the 4x4 Jeep. I just thought, Lord, you are so good. Thankfully, I have a dad who takes every moment like that to say, told you so. Good dads do that. Our return to America happened when I was 10 and a half years old. Dad applied to three places. One was a dream job in the Midwest. One was a really, really good job in Colorado Springs. And one was a fallback in Spokane, Washington. And the one from Colorado Springs called him up and said, Sam, you don't want this job. We are absolutely dysfunctional. Don't take it. That is an unbelievable example of honesty and leadership. Because how easy would it have been just to say, hey, you could help us come, right? But they said, we're a mess, and we don't want to invite you into that mess. The ideal job didn't send their acceptance to Dad until the day after the deadline when he had already accepted Spokane, Washington. Day after. A big package, multiple letters that had been sent and lost. They just got waylaid, and they finally show up the day after. So Dad had his own existential crisis, right? Spokane, Washington, or the ideal job. But here we are, right? Here we are. God is not in the business of taking from his children. He's in the business of giving. So this is where we are. The countless ways I've been blessed by being with you all in this part of the country. One very small one, but it's huge for me. Mom and Dad bought a house on the Little Spokane River. That river was a lifesaver to me. I used to wake up every morning, roughly 6 o'clock, and go fish for an hour just to calibrate myself for the school day because I needed it so badly. Coming back was brutal. Culture shock, it's a real deal. Okay? When we came back, it wasn't simply that everyone was white. That was awful. Believe it or not, I just thought something is seriously wrong. I didn't know how to make friends with somebody who had a similar color with me. All of my friends, everybody I dearly respected, had a different color. But the worst part was Sears. Going into Sears. Oh my goodness. The lawn mowing section alone. I walked in there and I just broke down in tears. Where have we come? What kind of a people would be so lazy as to need riding lawnmowers? We used to have this piece of steel that would bend at the very tip and it would be sharp on both sides, slashers we called them, and we would just cut the grass this way. And you could get pretty level with that. It took a very long time, and so I have just, for your comfort, adjusted. I'm a fan of riding lawnmowers now. But this river that God gave me, it had enough similarities to Africa, kind of that quiet, calibrating blue, and the blue herons, and the bird life. And the quiet beaver. And if I was quiet and calm enough, I could notice things that were really unusual, really. Just the other day, I'm sitting in my dad's backyard. They still live on this river, and we're talking together. And I look up in the cottonwood tree, and I see about 100 feet up, a little raccoon head stick out. I'm like, middle of the day. That's kind of weird. And we sat there long enough to watch the mama come down and 4 little babies follow after mom down this trunk. That's just an amazing sight. You guys are looking at me like I need to get out more. It's amazing. So I want you to notice, though, that this river, even though I didn't grow up on a river in Kenya, there were enough similarities that those places sang together. They sang to each other in my heart. I need you to remember that as we go through this talk. Different, right? Two different things, totally different locations, but they sing together. They harmonized for me. I could walk its rocky floor without looking down. I had a somatic relationship with the water. I got so used to feeling the current that it was just a part of who I was. You have similar places in your life. And you know what I'm about to say. God isn't in the business of taking from his children. He's in the business of giving. I met this pretty girl in 10th grade, a spunkalicious freckled talker. My, could she talk. Which was fine by me, because I was deathly quiet. And I could just sit there and listen to greatness happening, just such happiness all the time. She's thankful she's not sitting in the front row right now. She invited me to join her youth group in putting on a vacation Bible school in McCall, Idaho. It was a ministry to the families in that little town. And at the end of the week, we had a day of just celebration, swimming, playing hard, swimming again, playing hard, swimming again, playing some more. It was a great day. At the end of which, we played some tennis. So I was playing her youth pastor and these two other kids. And I started to feel chest pains. And I'd had these before in high school, so I didn't think anything of it. In sports, when I played tennis at Mead, I would just call timeout and pretend like, you know, I just need to think through the game. But I was really just trying to get air in my lungs. And we didn't know what it was at the time. But it just got worse and worse and worse until finally I just said, I got to stop. And they said, oh, it's getting dark. We'll walk the quarter mile back to camp anyways. And so we started trudging off down the road. I couldn't get air. And so in one of Ben Palpin's best skills in life, I know how to hide things really well. And so I just said, hey, you guys go. You go. I'll catch up. I'm just really tired. And it was not but a few minutes later that I just crumpled to the ground. I could not get air. Thankfully, they were close enough. They heard me, and they rushed back, picked me up, carried me back to camp, threw me in the back of this van. And I still remember being in that van, lying prone while they hauled to the ER. And I remember my friends sitting there and this pretty girl right next to me. I remember the moment a little bit like when I almost drowned when I was 7. I remember sinking to the bottom of the pool. And as I went down, I knew that nobody was seeing me, and I knew I was toast. And so I just stuck my hand up as high as I could in the water and let go. And I remember at the age of 7 just saying, Lord, I'm yours. Help me. And then I sank. And these strong arms grabbed me, pulled me out of the water, and I, you know, vomited all over the edge of the pool, of course, in glorious fashion. And I look up, and it's my dad. It's my dad in his full clothes that jumped in to get me. This moment in the van was not dissimilar. I remember giving everything to God and saying, I don't think I'm going to live. I'm not getting air. It's not like you're like, I'm getting little breaths. I'm not getting air. And I remember vowing to the Lord, if you let me live, I will take care of that pretty girl the rest of my days. Totally selfless. That's right. And the worst part of it is that God knew I wouldn't be able to keep my word, right? Like, have I really taken care of my wife like I promised? Not even close. That was a wake-up call to my soul. The diagnosis, they were able to pump me with a needle. It's gross. I don't need to tell you. Amy knows what I'm talking about. They woke me up. They got my body into a mode of, we got to survive, and so I lived. And the doctors called my dad and said, your son has costochondritis, which is a genetic disease that we didn't know I had. But it's different from pleurisy. Costochondritis is an inflammation of the cartilage that connects the upper ribs to the sternum. Pleurisy is an infection of the thin membrane there. So they have some similarities, but this is a genetic part of my life. But God isn't in the business of taking from his children. He's in the business of giving. What looks like loss always turns to gain. When you open your hand and let things go, God fills your hand with goodness you could never have imagined. A year later in college, I was reading Jonathan Edwards' personal narrative and narratives, and I found this little gem. Quote, I was at times very uneasy, especially towards the latter part of my time at college, when it pleased God to seize me with a pleurisy in which he brought me nigh to the grave and shook me over the pit of hell. And yet it was not long after my recovery before I fell again into my old ways. But God would not suffer me to go on with any quietness. Edward struggled with poor health throughout his life. And it seems that Edwards and I share a similar road. A sense of the body dragging us down, keeping us back from a full life, which isn't true, but it feels that way. In the first few months of our marriage, Kristen got horribly sick for 10 days or so. I remember thinking, well, I guess this is what I signed on for. I mean, in sickness or in health, I guess I'll have to be the noble provider for this sickly girl, which is just so ironic. I mean, she is healthy as a rock, and I'm the one who's had to need help. I developed migraine headaches early in my teaching career at North Central High School. They were so bad I couldn't see anything, which is really awful when you've been hired to teach strictly gang kids. So I got really good at just calling blindly, Spencer, knock it off. Just following the sixth sense that I would get. And they'd go, how did he know? I had no idea. A couple of years into my teaching career, I was hired on at the Oaks on a Sunday in January of 2008, honey, was that right? Roughly. I woke up from a nap and couldn't walk. I was in the basement, and I crawled upstairs. I crawled outside the back door, and my brain was so on fire that I burrowed my head into the foot and a half of snow and just prayed that it would cool down whatever was burning up my brain. My 4-year-old son found me. I said, Dad, what you doing? He's actually had many times in his life where he's asked me that question. This is not normal behavior. Over the next 2 weeks, my motor function and brain function declined rapidly. I had tremors that look a lot like Parkinson tremors, which I still deal with off and on. I had difficulty feeding myself. Comprehension crashed, memory crashed. On our drives to church, I would have a sheet of your names, and I would try to memorize them for short-term memory, hoping that I would remember them when I saw you. To this day, you'll catch me saying your name a lot in the middle of sentences. You know, Dan, who I've known forever since we were, well, not that long. But forever, and I will keep saying your names to you. That's just me lodging it in my brain to say, remember this person you love, okay? So I still have some of those issues to this day, and we don't have clear medical answers, only debates, which is a real treat for sick people. And every side of the debate believes they are thoroughly correct. We don't have any of that happening today in the world. A dear friend during this time read me this passage, Isaiah 50, verses 10 through 11. Who among you fears the Lord? Well, that's me. Who obeys the voice of his servant? I try. Who walks in darkness and has no light? Me. if I'm honest. Let him trust in the name of the Lord and rely upon his God. Look, all you who kindle a fire, who encircle yourselves with sparks, go ahead and walk in the light of your fire and in the sparks you have kindled. This you shall have from my hand. You shall lie down in torment. Well, I got really good at lighting little fires around me to avoid everything I feared most. Any kind of failure was unacceptable. My friend, who you'll, he's Frank. He told me, you're not a human being anymore, Ben. You're a human doing. You always try to out-hustle disaster. You're trying to hedge against failure. And he was right. I was doing anything I could to avoid the darkness, to avoid the loneliness of depression, to avoid the fear of isolation. Depression, that unspeakable D word, across all of society. He said, nothing else seems to be working, Ben. Why don't you try sitting in the dark with God? Sit until God, the great physician, chooses to show his light. Stay on your cross until God chooses to take you down. Sit, then stand, and maybe someday you can walk. Well, during this time, I just wanted a normal life. I just wanted normalcy. So to get there, I started with baby steps, literally. Walking to the mailbox, which is, it's a hefty 30 feet. Hefty. And I would get there, and it would take a very long time, and I'd reach the mailbox and think, how am I going to make it back? This is very awkward. I would. And when I did, it was this massive achievement in my life. My friend asked me one day, have you ever asked God to do whatever it takes to draw you closer to him? Are you joking? Are you sick? Who prays that kind of prayer? Which just revealed my relationship with God, right? Who am I to say that God needs my permission to do what he's going to do to his children whom he loves anyways, right? But I was terrified. I was terrified that he might actually do it. So I started taking bike rides when I got better, short bike rides. But I would say, today, I'm going to pray that prayer. And I would get home, and it had not happened. And I would go the next day. Today I'm going to pray that prayer. It's not that hard. It's pretty short. And I would get home, not done. It took me forever. I won't even tell you how long. Before I could actually say sincerely to my Father, my Abba, Lord, do whatever you need to do to draw me closer to yourself. God isn't in the business of taking from his children. He's in the business of giving. And sure enough, when I was able to get back into the classroom, I was a far better teacher. I was more patient. I was more empathetic. I had realized the deeper waters that God speaks to in our lives, and I could see those in my students. It was life-changing for me as a teacher and as a dad. All the old symptoms slowly made a comeback a few years ago. They knocked me out of the classroom again. So I decided that I would just walk and pray. I was able to walk. I couldn't understand anything. I don't have time for all these stories, but I told you I'm a storyteller. So I visited my friend Eric Ingard's class one day. He only talks in Latin, which is super frustrating for us English folks. But today he was reading a fable in English. So I'm like, wow, my lucky day. English. And at the end, he read it with classic Ingard fashion, great energy. And at the end, he said, and all I picked up, by the way, was that there was a lion involved. Everything else just disappeared. And so at the end of this fable, he said, Mr. Balbin, wasn't that wonderful? What did you think of yada, yada, yada. And I went, oh, I felt like I was in seventh grade again. Like, don't call on me. Thankfully, my teacher instincts were still good. And I had noticed that, you know, Carson Spratt had not really been paying attention. So I said, Mr. Ingard, why are you calling on a fellow teacher? Call on Carson. And he got, oh, yes, indeed, Carson, help me out. And the kid's like, what did I do to deserve this? So I would walk into a classroom, I would call a kid out, I would listen to the spirit, and I would just randomly say, Elizabeth, come with me. And they would always think they're busted. So we took a while to get over that. And then I'd say, when we got in the hallway, we're going to walk to the front of the building and back to the classroom. And in that amount of time, I want you to tell me two things you're thankful for and two things you want me to pray for. And that's all I could handle. So they would tell me, and at the door, I would make sure that I got it. And with my crabbed penmanship, which was hardly legible, it was very embarrassing to do this in front of students, I would write it down in my little prayer journal, and then I would walk and pray for them as I could. It turned out to be such a blessing to me and to these students. Things that, to this day, I've had parents who come to me and say, do you remember when you were praying for my kid? That meant more than you could ever know. And it was nothing. It was really nothing. All I had to do was walk around and pray for somebody. I started reading Makoto Fujimura, a Christian painter whose life work is a reflection on the way God uses pulverized materials to create something beautiful. Fujimura combines traditional Japanese techniques and materials to create multi-layered, often over 100 layers on his paintings, non-representational paintings that invite us into a bodily engagement with them. Mako has said that if you want to understand his work, you have to sit in front of one painting for 10 minutes, which I did. 10 minutes in front of Silence Mysterion. It's 33 feet wide. It's a monumental piece of work. David Brooks, in his New York Times article, said that after 10 minutes, what had seemed like a plain blue canvas now looked like an entire galaxy of color. He was right. At that moment, I just burst into tears. It was so beautiful. Mako also taught me about kintsugi art. Kintsugi means golden joinery. It's the Japanese art of repairing broken pottery by mending the areas of breakage with lacquer dusted or mixed with powdered gold. This tradition treats breakage as part of the story of an object and an opportunity for greater beauty rather than something to disguise. Most repair work is meant to create a seamless joint in our world, right? Ellie does not want me to fix her horse in any other way that it just looks back to normal. Sometimes I succeed. But kintsugi art does not treat it that way. It highlights the breakage, actually. So we tend to treat our breakage in our life like we do that broken horse, right? We want super glue and we want no evidence. So it's very American to pretend like everything is fine. We don't need help. We'll get through this. Have you heard that? We'll get through this. It's not very Christian. It's called self-reliance, and it's an ugly rebellion against the God who made us and transformed us. We don't fix trauma. We never get to the other side of it, actually, either. We learn to wear it better, but it is always a part of us. Revelations 21:5, Jesus says, I make all things new. When American ears hear that, they think, oh, goody. Out with the old, in with the new. Right? You can have my crappy Pinto. Give me a Tesla. He hasn't done that for me yet. Sometimes he does, right? Sometimes he does. But most of the time, he breaks the old and reconstitutes it into something radiant, a testimony to his goodness and to the way he crafts us. We warp that process. We even dare I say, hinder God's craftsmanship when we pretend we don't have struggles or when we try to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. We hinder beauty by not being honest. This second health collapse led to a permanent departure from the classroom. I don't know for how long. I still have a teacher's heart, but I lack the stamina. Instead, he's given me an incredible stamina for writing, so that's what I'm doing a lot of. And it's touching people in such humbling ways, people I've never met. It is, sometimes you'll hear writers talk about how great it is to be, you know, making an impact on people's lives. It's a very sobering thing in my life. I feel sometimes when I get these letters like I should put the pen away. This is way bigger than me. But I think it's not me doing this, truly. God's using my life, my stories, and giving me things to say, and I'm saying those things as honestly as I can. I'd encourage you to do the same. Because God isn't in the business of what? He's in the business of giving. Because I need to remember, record, and reaffirm what God has done in the past, I'm telling you my story. I need to remember, record, and reaffirm what God has done in the past so that I can live, so that I can notice what he's doing now, and so that I can look forward to what he's going to do in the future. The ground of our hope is in the story of God's activity in our lives, in our fathers' lives and their fathers before them, all the way back to Augustine and Paul and Elijah and Adam. That's why God calls his people to remember over and over again. Remembering always takes narrative shape. We are storytelling, story-reading creatures. That's the only way we know how to interpret existence. It's our factory setting. The consequences of not remembering, recording, and reaffirming what God has done in our lives is frightening. One of the first signs of soul decay is storytelling decay. A soul that is decaying stops telling the story of what God has done in its life. Then it stops noticing what God is doing right now. And sooner or later, it's going to stop noticing or looking forward to what God will do in the future. And then we have no relationship. The decaying soul shifts the narrative heartbeat from what God has done to what it is doing. It starts noticing only what it's doing at the present time, and it stops looking for God's deliverance in the future. So now it's all about them. I tell you my story so that our stories can sing to each other, so they can harmonize, so they can say more than one story alone can say about God's faithfulness. Remember what I talked about? Different things, right? Can sing to each other, can harmonize. Our stories are just like that. You don't have my story. I can't tell you how many people have said, boy, you're so lucky. You grew up in Kenya, Africa. It must have been amazing. Like, dude, you live here. It is crazy better than where I lived. But wherever you are, always feels just so absolutely boring, normal, right? Anywhere else would be better. This is one of the important aspects of community. We speak into each other's lives, remembering together, recording together, reaffirming together. Faith is learning to see the story of which I am a part and actively stepping into that story, trusting the story to be good. It may not look good. It may not feel good at the time, but I have faith that God is the first and best and prime storyteller who knows what he's doing, by the way. Faith is a tenuous and tenacious discipline of memory and hope, remembering those moments when God was as evident as the sun in the sky and his work in my life was irrefutable. The poet Christian Wiman said that Christ speaks in stories as a way of preparing his followers to stake their lives on a story, because existence is not a puzzle to be solved, but a narrative to be inherited and undergone, a story that transforms person by person, and I would add family by family, church by church. Faith is the moment by moment, day by day, year by year commitment to trust the storyteller, to stake one's life on the story he tells us we have inherited. This weekend is our opportunity to bolster our community by remembering, recording, and reaffirming what God has done in our lives. This weekend is our chance to entrench our relationships and our faith. It's our chance to let our stories sing to each other, to harmonize. How do we do that? We start asking each other different questions instead of asking, "So, what do you do?" Which, by the way, isn't a bad question. It's okay. Or, "How was your week?" Which is fine. Or, "How are you feeling?" Which is not okay. If you don't ever ask a sick person, "So, how are you feeling?" It just tempts us to lie, okay? So don't ask the question. But we can start asking questions like, "Tell me your story." Or, "How did you two meet? How did you come to the faith? How can I pray for you this week? What are you struggling with most as a parent? What have you been learning from this season in your life?" These are narrative questions. They force engagement. They generate further conversation. They force honesty and vulnerability. They provide opportunity for shared experience, stories that harmonize and help each other. That's why they are faith-building questions. So why don't we ask these questions? I think it's because we don't want to pry. We don't want to sound nosy. I mean, we know people who are nosy, and we don't want to be those folks. So we don't end up asking the questions that God has called us to ask of each other. We don't ask story-generating questions so we can just skate along the surface and we don't have to dive down into the deep waters of each other's lives. And you can coexist for a very long time. Many marriages do. But sooner or later, that ice breaks and somebody's surprised, right? Instead of realizing all along, "My goodness, there are deep waters here." Why don't we tell our stories? We don't want to sound self-centered. We don't want to come across as me, me, me. But holding out on telling our stories is holding out on shared life together. It's a false modesty that doesn't want to be vulnerable. We have a choice. Either take the risk for the sake of shared faith-building life together, or don't take a risk and settle for a cerebral engagement with God and with each other. If we don't tell our stories, sooner or later, we'll have soul decay. Sooner or later, we'll stop hoping. We'll stop looking up and leaning out. We'll stop beholding. Sooner or later, we'll stop climbing the mountain altogether. This summer, my son had a brilliant idea. I'm not being sarcastic. It was a great idea. To do a hike to Blanca Lake, which is a glacial lake up in the mountains near where I live. I'm human. Behold. Son, help me. Cascades, thank you. Super complicated. So this hike, I don't know if Noah told me this or I just thought it was only 3 miles. Turned out to be 4.5 miles. 3,500-foot elevation change within those first 3 miles. That's a lot for a pencil pusher like me. I'm sweating just standing here. And not all of us can be Andy Schumann. I'm sorry. So when we got to this parking lot at the head of the trail, it was full. I might be exaggerating, but 30 to 40 cars in this parking lot in the middle of nowhere. It was astonishing. I think everybody was so sick of being indoors that they all decided to go climb this one trail, which meant We were passing people every 3 to 5 minutes. What was the topic of conversation? Me with my one little water bottle, trying to ration out the first half all the way up and the second half all the way down. Three things kept coming up, right? They would ask me, because I looked like a train wreck, "Are you doing okay?" That was the first topic of conversation, followed by, "Hey, how much further do I have to go?" Right? And then they would tell me, I would think, "Oh, man, I have been trekking it for a long time." By the way, I don't really haul. If you've been around me, I take very slow steps. So I'd be going for 45 minutes. I have to have gone like 2.5 miles, 3, maybe 4. And they're like, "Oh, you're at the mile mark. You're doing great. Oh, so much further to go." But what was the third question? What was the third topic of conversation? Is the payoff worth it? Is Blanca Lake really everything it's supposed to be? And to a person, they said, "Oh, it's amazing." So I kept climbing, right? Because these are hope-filling conversations. They are faith-building conversations. They are the core of the Christian life. We ask each other, "Are you doing okay?" The question back is, "Hey, you look like you're further down this particular road of parenting than I am. Could you help me with this? Because this is really hard." Right? We ask those who've gone before us, whatever it is, in suffering, parenting, college, whatever it is, "Hey, is it everything it's supposed to be?" And then we can give each other the encouragement we need. But you know how that happens? It only happens when we tell each other our stories. If you just say, "Yeah, it's great, keep it up," that's going to last like 5 seconds, right? But when I remember stories, some of your stories, I think, "Oh my goodness." You need to ask Kent Young about a miracle moment when God provided in his extended family's life. You just have to. It's one of my favorite faith-building stories of all time. Sorry, Kent, you're going to be mobbed later. Which brings us back to our verse for the weekend, Isaiah 40, verse 9. "Go on up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good news. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift it up, fear not, say to the cities of Judah, behold your God." We're given a title we don't get to choose. We are heralds of good news. We're called to be storytellers of that good news. God commands us to tell our story fearlessly, courageously, without any sort of, "Well, it's just my story." No, God's telling this story, so it's beautiful and meaningful. God commands us to point every eye to him, to use our stories as a vehicle to draw attention to his blessed and eternal craftsmanship in our lives. Joshua 4, you remember this moment. "When all the nation had finished passing over the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, 'Take 12 men from the people, from each tribe a man, and command them, saying, Take 12 stones from here out of the midst of the Jordan, from the very place where the priest's feet stood firmly, and bring them over with you, and lay them down in the place where you lodge tonight.' Then Joshua called the 12 men from the people of Israel, whom he had appointed, a man from each tribe. And Joshua said to them, 'Pass on before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan, and take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, that this may be a sign among you. When your children ask in time to come, what do these stones mean to you? Then you shall tell them a story. You shall tell them this story of my deliverance." What are these stones but reminders to remember a story? In our home, we have this basket on my bookshelf. It's filled with rocks. They have the date on one side, and they have a brief description of what happened. This is our family's Joshua basket. These are the stories that move our hearts. They transform our hearts, and they propel us to trust God again. These are the stories we are called to remember, record, and reaffirm so that we stay awake to what He is doing right now in our family, so we can live in expectation for what He will do in the future. This is catching hold. This is beholding. These are the stories that sing to each other of God's enduring goodness and faithfulness. Let's stand and close with the doxology.